It is my pleasure to welcome and introduce our speaker for this evening. Dr. Robert Bristow is currently a scientist at Princess Margaret Hospital with laboratory programs in prostate cancer biology and DNA repair. He currently is the chair of the CARO Translational Biology Task Force and co-administrator of the Canadian Prostate Cancer Bio Research Network. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dr. Bristow.
Well, this is an absolute honor to come and talk to you tonight. Tonight what I wanted to do with you is two things. One is to talk about some new technologies that are going to be available either now or in the next year or two for patients in terms of trying to understand which patients may be best treated by either surgery or radiation therapy or indeed watchful waiting. So no treatment at all, but just active observation. And then another part of tonight, I want to dream with you about how we can potentially use some up-and-coming technologies that aren't available quite yet, but might be in the next 5 to 10 years, in which instead of lumping together people, patients, and their families, patients as basically a group of the same men who have the same PSA, T stage, and Gleason score, and then giving kind of a standard treatment for a certain category. It's dreaming about taking each one of the men in this room or other men who might be diagnosed with prostate cancer and develop an individual treatment for them based on their own genetics or what I'll call a fingerprint, a genetic fingerprint, and therefore provide the best chances for potential cure and then also provide the least amount of side effects. So that's what we're going to talk about today. Now, I've got some fancy slides up here, but I'm going to try to bring it down home in terms of simple messages. And if any time someone is getting lost with this, put up your hand, all right? And I'll just rework everything. But I'm here to answer your questions. I'm here to tell you about some exciting technologies. This is not, ready to go right now for some of these technologies, and I'll be very honest about telling you which ones those are. But I do want to at least tease this audience and tease other people who may fear the diagnosis of prostate cancer with the hope that in the future that we can do much better than we're doing now. And maybe I'll just go ahead and start on with the presentation. So I would give a letter as a radiation oncologist to a referring doctor, either to a referring urologist or to a general practitioner, that would be slightly different than this in terms of the use of the language, but basically the message would be the same. So let's read this together. So, dear Dr. Smith, Mr. Johnson has a 1 centimeter lump in the left prostate, but no spread elsewhere, and presumably this is being on the basis of CT scans and bone scans. The pathology and the bulk of the tumor suggest that we should go on to radical treatment for cure, so that would be either surgery or radiation therapy or a combination of radiation plus hormones, which I'll talk about in just a moment. We discussed the main options, and he's decided to go ahead with radical radiotherapy, require a few planning steps. He's going to be on a clinical trial. We're going to use Casodex with the radiation therapy, and we're going to use this new type of radiotherapy treatment, so-called IMRT, or intensity modulated radiation therapy. And with this new technology, he has little chance of long-term damage to the bladder and to the rectum, and about a 75 to 85% chance of taking that PSA, let's say it's 10 or so, down to a value of less than 1.5 and staying there for the first 5 years. And if he fails that, in other words, if there was a 15 to 25% chance that unfortunately, God forbid, the radiation didn't work, we still have other options such as hormone therapy. So that is today. That's the type of letter that I would give to a physician after seeing a patient in consultation. Now, in a perfect world, I think we all would agree that prostate cancer would not exist. But in fact, we don't live in that world. But let's think of a better world, perhaps, than the one that is now, in which if prostate cancer was an entity, could we not individualize the treatment to each and every patient and perhaps use non-invasive ways? This is not to necessarily take business away from the surgeons, but the idea would be that if we didn't have to do surgery, is there a way to do that and still get the great results that surgery achieves, but actually give less toxicity or side effects and always lead to a cure? So that's the part that I want to dream with you a little bit for the next hour or so until the coffee break, and then maybe come back and talk for a few minutes afterwards and say, how could we do that? And what's out there to kind of pluck at in terms of the fruit on the tree to try to get there? So in terms of a pathway, we know that clearly once the development of prostate cancer exists, and that could be due to a number of factors, including in a small proportion of men, particularly young men, maybe genetic factors, but also due to issues pertaining to diet and age, for example. But there are a number of current therapies, which include surgery, radiotherapy, either in terms of external beam radiotherapy or in terms of brachytherapy, hormone therapy, and potentially combinations of these, and watchful waiting for patients who may have very low-risk disease and disease that may not progress very rapidly. And then clearly there would be a patient outcome. That means in terms of their PSA going down and hopefully eradication of the disease. I want to give two concepts regarding the outcome of surgery, radiation therapy, or hormone therapy, as well as the potential factors that might make patients resistant to those therapies. The first is what we call genetics, or the genes that are basically in our cells, that are contained in the chromosomes. And there are a number of factors or genes that become abnormal during the process of cancer, which might give us some sort of, as I said, fingerprint or information for an individual patient that we could say whether or not these type of therapies would be useful for that particular patient and whether or not there's any chance for distant metastatic spread or spread of the disease elsewhere in the body. Because if there was, then we should use some sort of agent that goes through the body, not only local therapy such as surgery or radiotherapy, to prevent that. Not only in terms of the genes within cells, but the way that the cells are actually come together within a solid tumor, the so-called environment of the tumor, the tumor microenvironment, is also important. And one of the issues that, again, we think determines how cells, cancer cells, respond to therapy, as well as the propensity for distant spread, may be the levels of oxygen in the tumor. And I'm going to talk about both of these tonight. So I think for many people in this audience, this is a truism, that the finger, in other words, the digital rectal examination, with the PSA can lead to treatment. And that could either be to external beam, or to radioactive seeds, or to surgery in terms of the knife. And the question I want to talk about tonight is who benefits the most from each one of these types of treatments. And I will tell you right now that we have a fairly good idea of the types or groupings of patients that will do well with, for example, brachytherapy or external beam therapy, radiotherapy, or surgery. And then other patients who really shouldn't have surgery at all, but should just have radiation plus hormones. But what I mean is that if I have a group of patients where I think maybe surgery would be just as good as radiation therapy, wouldn't it be nice to give feedback to my patients and say, no, you shouldn't have radiation therapy because your genetics suggests that in fact you might have a resistance gene. And why put you through 42 treatments of radiation if I know that before starting the radiation, and therefore I'm sending you back to the surgeon to have surgery because that is the best treatment. So from that standpoint, there is a way of potentially choosing one treatment over the other by more interesting and more defined criteria based on an individual patient's genes or what their chromosomes are. Okay, I'm going to talk mostly about the potential role of genetics or genes in cells as relates to radiation therapy tonight. I'm a radiation oncologist. But I want to start off this presentation by being very clear that the types of processes or genetics that I'm going to talk about will also have absolute implications to the potential success of surgery, for example, as well as the potential success of even diagnosing prostate cancer in the very beginning, so the so-called risk of prostate cancer in a patient that might have a slightly elevated PSA, but whose biopsies are coming back negative, and how worried does that patient have to be? Well, maybe the genetics will help us in determining which patients really just need to be followed and have no treatment whatsoever, or which patients need active treatment such as surgery or radiation. But I'm going to focus on radiation as a radiation oncologist. So in terms of non-invasive therapies, radiation therapy is the most effective treatment of cancer, and it acts at a molecular level, or the molecules or genes in the cells, to induce cancer cell death. It will also, as we'll see in a moment, induce death in normal cells, but its ability to create death more in cancer cells relative to normal cells allows us to use radiation therapy effectively and actually have minimal side effects from time to time. Now, our program at Princess Margaret Hospital is a very large program. It is the largest radiation treatment facility in the world. We have 16 linear accelerators. we have what are called simulators that we use with CAT scans, and now we have a new, which is one of only three in the world, an MRI machine that we actually use solely for simulating radiation therapy. So other than just diagnostic MRIs, which many hospitals have, we have an MRI that is directly hooked up now to the planning system, and that may be very important for planning prostate radiotherapy because it gives us elegant pictures of the prostate, which CT scan gives us good pictures, but not perfect pictures. So we, as the largest treatment facility, have 32 doctors like myself who are radiation oncologists, and we give approximately 9,000 courses of radiotherapy each and every year. So when you come to see me or a surgeon or any urologist, for example, we tend to classify patients into what we call risk groups, and many of you are already aware of this. The first is what we call low risk. And when I say risk, I mean two things. One, risk refers to the risk of a tumor actually becoming active and aggressive locally and causing local problems within the prostate. And the other part of the risk is the ability of those cells to escape from the prostate and potentially going elsewhere in the body, either to the lymph nodes or through the bloodstream as distant metastases. And so we're going to go through briefly these risk groups just so I can illustrate the role of radiation, and this is based on all radiation oncologists across Canada getting together in one meeting and deciding that these are the criteria or the risk groups and what we felt are the best therapies at the present time. So low-risk patients, basically we would have fairly low PSAs in terms of relative PSA, of values less than 10. They would have Gleason scores of 6 or less, so 4, 5, or 6 out of 10. And early-stage prostate cancers, which either you can't feel with your, the doctor can't feel doing the digital rectal exam, or it feels as just a single bump, the so-called T1 or T2 tumors. So these tumors have not gone outside the capsule or the rind, as I say, of the orange of the prostate, and these are fully contained within the prostate. These patients do not require hormone therapy, and they are probably equally treated by either surgery, external beam radiotherapy to doses now closer to 80 gray rather than 70 gray as the slide shows, or bracket therapy. Based on survival following these therapies in terms of whether or not a patient would die of their prostate cancer, as well as the results with PSA, it appears now that these three treatments are equal for the low-risk category. Contained within the low-risk category is a very low-risk grouping, which may not even need treatment at all. And these are very low Gleason scores with low PSAs in which sometimes we just follow them in. And you know about that. That's called the so-called watchful waiting. An intermediate risk group is when the characteristics of the cells, both under the microscope as well as the PSA, leads to a little bit more potential aggressive risk in terms of growing and causing problems locally, or again, an increased risk for going outside the prostate gland. And these are patients now who have PSAs between 10 and 20. A Gleason score of 7, or again, they can have contained tumors as what are we called T1 or T2, either you can feel the bump or you can feel the bump, but the PSA is a little higher and the Gleason score is a little higher. Here there are a number of choices for men, and probably the most controversy exists about what types of treatments there should be. For example, surgery can be used, the radical prostatectomy, as well as so-called conformal or high-dose radiation therapy. Again, external beam is favored in this category rather than the brachytherapy that was favored in low-risk patients. And then whether or not patients receive hormone therapy really are the basis of current clinical trials to see whether that will add anything to the radiotherapy or to the surgery for these patients. But this is an interesting group of patients in that even though we're categorizing these patients as intermediate risk as a group, it turns out that probably within that group there's a wide spectrum of response and a wide spectrum of risk. And this particular group is one of the groups of patients that we want to develop genetic tests for to decide who should have surgery, who should have radiation therapy, and what is the pace of their potential prostate cancer in terms of designing therapies. High-risk patients, and these are patients, again, that have disease, that there's no evidence of metastasis or spread to the lymph nodes or to the bone, so we're just talking about local characteristics of the tumor. These patients have PSAs that are greater than 20. They have a Gleason score of 8, 9, or 10 out of 10. And now that we call this stage T3 or T4, which is that the prostate tumor has gone outside the capsule of the actual gland. So either it exists as a very sharp bump in which it's gone outside, or in the T4 case, it can be a fairly large tumor in some men in which it actually could touch the rectum, for example, right behind the prostate.
these patients should not have surgery. I think there's a consensus both in terms of surgeons as well as radiation oncologists that because the disease has gone beyond the prostate, it would be very difficult to use a knife to actually remove that tumor by surgery alone. It could leave cells behind that might require further types of therapy, such as post-operative radiation or post-operative hormone therapy. The idea behind these therapies is to get the cancer as best as you can on the first run around. So these patients, there is consensus around the world that they should have radiation therapy in addition to hormone therapy, which can course through the entire body and potentially kill any cells that might have gone outside the prostate or spread anywhere else that we can't pick up by a bone scan or a CAT scan. Because in order to pick up this disease by a bone scan or a CAT scan, the disease has to have about 100 million cells in it. And that's the tip of your little finger, about a centimeter, that we can pick up. If it's smaller than that, we can't actually see it on a bone scan or a CT scan. So if there was a deposit of 10,000 cells, for example, somewhere in the body, we currently don't have a technique by the current radiology test to actually find those cells. I'll come back to that as part of the new technology in which maybe we can define another way of doing things a little bit better. So that's the background by which I want to basically place these new genetic tests and new types of radiation technologies, knowing that radiation, at least, has a role in each of these categories. Surgery has certainly a strong role in the first and second, the low and intermediate, but not the high-risk category. And the idea, of course, is then to choose the best patients within a category for the best type of treatment and give you feedback about that. Because you know sometimes the doctor, you'll see the surgeon, and you'll see the radiation oncologist, and you'll go back to your family physician and say, they both seem equal. I don't know. You know, what about, and the side effects are slightly different, but I'm not sure. And how do I know that the side effects aren't going to affect me versus someone else? So that's what we hope to help you with in the future. So in terms of the research and the clinical programs that are ongoing at my institute, and this I think represents a number of different radiation institutes across Canada, perhaps we have a little bit more in terms of the number of researchers and the number of projects, but everyone is interested, I think, in these issues. We want to give you the best opinion on your cancer management, and we want to give you an unbiased opinion. And if I was in the United States, for example, sometimes some of you are aware there can be turf wars, because then the almighty dollar is involved in some sort of issues. But here, like it or not, actually the dollar is not that involved. So we want to have multidisciplinary clinics. You should demand or have your friends demand, if appropriate, your diagnosis to be discussed by both a radiation oncologist and a surgeon in order to choose. Okay? So we want to give the best opinion. We want to use the best equipment, the best way to give high precision therapy to the prostate gland, and therefore give the highest dose that we can, hopefully to give the best result in terms of reducing the PSA, but also give the lowest number of side effects with that precision radiation therapy. And of course, we want to continue to follow patients afterwards to give them support during and after their treatment. If, God forbid, the cancer came back, we want to have rapid ways of assessing for that, letting the patient know what that means, and then have treatments for it, and then also, of course, manage any damage that the radiation has caused, because that's part of being a doctor as well. We'd love to say that every type of cancer therapy doesn't have side effects, but in reality, it does. So in terms of our research program, I'm going to show you a new machine some of you may have heard about. It was on global television October 27th, which is called the Cone Beam CT Radiation Machine. And we've just started to do some imaging, and we're about to treat our first patient. It will not be in full use probably until about 2 years' time. But this is a type of radiation machine that allows you to use actually a CT scan at the same time you're irradiating in order to actually get perfect targeting during when even the radiation machine is turned on for the 5 minutes of treatment. In other words, it can follow if organs that move, so for lung cancer, if patients are breathing, sometimes the lung cancer moves, this machine can do that. Where before you'd have to have a CAT scan as kind of a static image or a window in time, and then we use and plan on that for your prostate radiotherapy planning, but we all know that sometimes you can have a bit of a full bladder or a bit of full or empty rectum that can slightly change the location of the prostate. Well, this machine will actually be able to modify where it's going to shoot the beam in a real-time effort. Okay, The other thing that I want to talk about today are basically molecules, which is the basis of radiation killing, and what we understand about that in terms of defining new targets for radiation treatment and new drugs that might work with radiation therapy, including gene therapy, and then also potential ways to repair normal tissues that have been damaged with radiation therapy and reduce the side effects. Now, radiation therapy works, as I said previously, in a very simple way in one concept, in that we want to kill more cancer cells than normal cells. In a perfect world, we'd like to kill no normal cells and only cancer cells. But as yet, there are few, if any, cancer therapies that actually work to that particular paradigm. So in this case, we'd like to kill more cancer cells in terms of a balanced equation of life or death in terms of irradiation. And this hopefully will give us tumor cure. But even though we know that we'll be killing some normal cells as well, those cells have an ability to regenerate themselves following radiation. And if this balance is tipped over towards the right here, then we have an effective treatment in terms of what we call a therapeutic ratio, where the ratio of side effects is less than, as where the number of side effects is less than the cancer cure. And so the marriage now, in the new kind of 21st century, is our ability to marry the technology that we have, the so-called precision radiotherapy, with the biology of patients in terms of the relative number of blood vessels and oxygenation and genetics. So if someone was coming to see me at Princess Margaret Hospital for our high-dose radiation program with external beam, some of you will know that we place three non-radioactive gold seeds into the prostate gland. Here is the prostate. This is the front of the symphysis pubis, or the pubic bone. This is the bladder above. This is your tailbone at the back, and the anal area is here. We actually use a transrectal ultrasound to insert, rather than remove by biopsy, three seeds that allows us to see a quick picture just before we shoot each one of the radiation treatments, and there are 42 in this particular treatment protocol, to actually see them and to make sure that our pink, which is the high dose region, is actually on target each day. And if the prostate moves slightly, we can move the beams in order to track that. So this gives us a much better way of actually making sure that there's always, in the blue, a high dose to the prostate gland, but sparing potential rectum or bladder above it. Because if we were shooting willy-nilly, it could mean that we are missing the prostate, but and just giving side effects to the normal tissues. We wanted to reduce that. And we're one of the only institutes in the world that has married the CT planning with these so-called seeds. And the way we actually do this is that we actually join the seeds like a little triangle, those three seeds, and this is a plain x-ray, and you can just maybe make out the head of one of the leg bones here, and this is taken from the side. And actually, our technicians are very good about seeing these seeds, and they can actually see whether or not this triangle, if they join the three seeds together, moves just ever so slightly. So you can see this small angle. That means that they've moved the beams ever so slightly to that angle to compensate for that. So that might be on day 5. But on day 8, maybe the triangle will go back a little bit. So for that treatment, the beams will go back. So it's in real time that we're able to target. And what that allows us to do, therefore, is if we think of dose in red here, is to give a very high dose of radiation to the prostate area, but then to rapidly have the dose fall off in other pelvic organs. So blue is cold, relatively cold. The gray actually doesn't see any radiation at all. And it is this ability that it actually is decreasing the side effects of radiation therapy these days to the point that we can now give another 2 weeks of radiation therapy to a much higher dose without any increased side effects whatsoever. And you'll hear this new type of radiation therapy talked about, intensity-modulated radiation therapy, which is a new way of calculating the dose and determining how many beams will come in to actually give this beautiful red irradiation zone and a rapid fall-off of dose away from the structure. And at Princess Margaret Hospital, we currently use it only for men that have large prostates because they're the ones who are most risk for side effects. But we hope to have every patient treated with this new type of technology starting at the beginning of next year. And this is just another from the side. Here is the rectum, here is the prostate, and here is the bladder, and these are little seminal vesicles, the two rabbit ear glands that are behind the prostate. And this just shows the type of, from the side, what it looks like when we give what are called dose clouds. So the high dose region here is in red, and everything else is rapidly falling off in dose. So you can see then there's a little bit of of coverage to the bladder here as well as to the front part of the rectum with the high-dose cloud, and that's why patients can have some side effects in terms of increased frequency of urination or a bit of discomfort during radiation because the urethra runs through the prostate that we pee out of every day, and that becomes a little agitated or inflamed. Similarly, the front part of the rectum can also become inflamed with the radiation as you get to higher doses, so there might be some bowel effects. But for the most part, this new type of technique gives less than 1% chance of late complications at 5 years, so severe complications to the bladder and rectum are no longer heard about. So that's something new. So the technology now, that's available today. Well, how can we start to integrate what I've been keeping talking about these genes? So let's talk about these genes. So how can we kind of integrate novel cancer treatment strategies with these molecular targets and these precise imaging techniques? And I think that everyone has a certain number of questions you're going to ask your doctor when you come to see them. So the first questions that usually my patients ask, and they may ask it slightly different than the questions are presented to you here, is this treatment for me? So if they're coming to a radiation oncologist, look, if I'm one of these intermediate risk group patients with a PSA of 14 and I know that the doctor can feel a bump and my Gleason score is 7, why should I have radiation versus surgery? Help me with this, because I've got two people I kind of trust, but the information is becoming confusing. So should I have radiation or should I have surgery? Tell me. And many times we have to say, well, that's your choice because they're equal, because I don't have any further information to help me with that type of decision or give you feedback on that type of decision. The second thing is, okay, Dr. Bristol, I've chosen radiation therapy, and you said there's a 75 to 85% chance that it's going to work. So am I the 75 or am I the 85, or am I even better than that? And why can't you tell me any more about that? And that's because we tend to lump patients together. And we lump them in this intermediate risk group, and I don't have individual genetic information or other types of information, which I'll talk about in a moment as the potential hope to answer that question for you. I just don't have it today. And, you know, you're telling me I'm going to go through this 8.5 weeks of radiation therapy, 42 treatments. How do you even know it's working? Like, wouldn't it be nice to know if it's working at week 3, maybe, and then if it's not working, I can go and have surgery before any damage is done? Potential damage is done, and I agree with you. And usually what we do is we wait for some weeks after the radiation therapy to take the first PSA and compare it before and after radiation in order for us to make that decision. Maybe there's a way to actually determine how the radiation is working during the radiation. But, you know, maybe we can do that by not having an invasive measure, in other words, taking a biopsy, but actually maybe tracking with a new type of X-ray maybe expression of certain genes that either are or are not turned on by the radiation. Maybe that's a signal of whether the radiation is working or not. So we'll talk about that in a second. And how do you know that I'm not the one that's going to be one in 50 to have these severe side effects? And if it is 75%, I want it 95%. How can we improve these results? And so the current answers are based on average numbers that I give based on randomized clinical trials, and I'd love to be able to give individual answers. So this looks like a busy diagram, but it's actually quite simple in concept, is that if we had a marker or a biological tool or even a readout of how a patient's tumor was going to respond to radiation therapy before we even started the radiation therapy, we could make better decisions about which patients should receive radiation therapy and which patients should not. And of the people who are going to receive radiation therapy, is there any way we can do better, quote unquote? Is there anything we can add to the radiation therapy to make their treatment 95% effective rather than maybe 75% effective? So we call these markers or genetic determinants or factors, just for a word, called biomarkers, biology markers. And some of them may have to do with how quickly the cell is dividing in the prostate, so-called cell cycle or the machinery of the gears of how cells divide. The other may have to do with how well a cancer cell can repair the damage imparted by the radiation therapy, so-called DNA repair proteins. And the other may have to do with what are called death-related proteins. And this is the grim reaper here. And there are a number of proteins that can determine whether a cell lives or dies following radiation therapy. And we know what those genes are. And so if we can put together an entire map across hot or cold parts of the tumor, maybe we can have kind of a summary score of how a patient is going to do. But we have to take a biopsy, and we have to have an ability to look at multiple biomarkers at the same time, not just one now, maybe hundreds or thousands. Because that's the reality that I deal with, and this is just one pathway. This is how DNA damage works. You don't have to know anything about this. I try every day to know something about this. The point is that there is a lot of information on this one little pathway. So how am I as a scientist supposed to decipher in patient A's tumor versus patient B's tumor all of these different interactions and whether or not this is going to in fact, impact on how a patient is going to respond to radiation therapy. Because I can tell you, if I put one of my postdoctoral fellows or graduate students on any one of these proteins, you can just multiply how many people I would need in order to get the information of all of these different proteins, hundreds, and it would take years and years and years. Okay. So the concept of genetic fingerprinting is to say, can we develop new technologies? Instead of taking 100 people, 100 years to do it, can instead of we get readout on one gene, which has usually been our approach until the last 2 or 3 years, instead let's get 20,000 genes out of one biopsy, and let's do it in 2 or 3 days, and let's have that information and turn it around and give it back to the patient and say, we can tell by your profile, looking at 20,000 different genes, that there's a certain pattern that suggests that you're going to be sensitive with the radiation and do just fine, or that you're not sensitive to the radiation and you should have surgery. Okay? And the same approach could be for a patient who might be at risk for prostate cancer, rising PSA, but a negative biopsy, or a patient who's young and has a family history of prostate cancer, and again, look at the pattern of the genes over 20,000 different markers and say, you know what, your pattern suggests that in fact you're going to be just fine, that you don't really have a higher risk of prostate cancer, or the opposite, you do have a high risk and we should do surgery now. So there are a number of things that a scientist can look at, and if this is the prostate gland and the cells of the prostate are called epithelial cells, tumors invade through the normal structures of the gland, and they can gain access, as I said, to the lymph nodes or to the blood. So if they gained access to the blood, we could take a blood sample maybe and look for the factors there, or we could put a needle right into the prostate gland and take out some tumor cells and look for these factors. And without going into too much detail, because I really don't think that's the basis of tonight's talk, we can look at the chromosomes in the cell, the DNA that is in the chromosomes, which basically is the hereditary material that cells use to divide with, and then proteins, for example, that are made from the DNA and from the chromosomes that are really the working building blocks of the cell. And so we have new technologies in order to look at that. Now, it turns out that, of course, with all of this information, we're hoping to be able to give better advice to patients. But also we have to be very careful with the information in that with normal tissues, for example, we could come up with other types of genes that might put patients at risk for other types of genetic diseases that they didn't know about. Maybe they didn't ever wanted to know about, and certainly they never wanted their insurance companies to know about. So we have to be very careful with the type of knowledge that we're actually acquiring here. And that's why for all of these tests I'm going to talk about, there are ethics boards in each hospital and each research institute that is very careful about how the biopsy material is being utilized for these high, what we call high impact or high power genetic tests. Because although I'm looking for one factor, or at least one endpoint, I could wind up getting a lot of other information that we have to be very careful with. And we have to make sure that that information is protected unless the patient wants us to tell them or wants to actually utilize that. So it's unlikely that a single gene is going to actually give us information about how the tumor is going to respond to radiation. And so we need to look at kind of multiple factors. And so this is a so-called kind of the magic of what's called a DNA microarray. And micro just being small, and array meaning array of thousands of genes. And the first instrument that actually allowed us to have an ability to look at tumor tissue from very small biopsies was something called a laser capture microdissector. It's basically a tiny, tiny little scalpel that exists on the basis of the end of a microscope lens. The scalpel is actually a UV laser, an ultraviolet laser, that has the ability to cut out tumor tissue from very, very tiny parts of a biopsy under the microscope and take that away from the remaining normal tissue. And then we can use a pure population of tumor cells to actually look at with our genetic test, because otherwise we'd have too much noise. If we have normal tissue as well as tumor tissue, the signal can be very mixed and the pattern is not clean. So we need to do this first step. So I won't go through these issues, but I'll just show you kind of a before and after this laser capture microdissector. If my technician in my lab carefully uses under the microscope a laser beam to dissect out this purple area here, which are the tumor cells, and we call this stroma, or normal cells in between in pink, this is what it looks like after we remove it, and here's what we've actually removed. A beautiful, pure population. You could just fit like a jigsaw puzzle, couldn't you? This part back into this part. But this allows us then not to have any noise from the normal tissue, but then to take these tumor tissues only, two of these genetic tests that I'm going to talk about. So this is what a microarray is, and you're going to hear more and more about it, and every once in a while you'll see a Globe and Mail article talk about these so-called DNA microarrays. And what it is that we have a robot that actually, this arm here is about the length, about the diameter of your steering wheel. That's how big it is. And each one of these are little microscope slides, just like you would have seen in grade 12 biology. So that's how small these are. On the slide, about the size of your thumbnail, are a series of tiny little dots you can barely perceive to your eye. You'd have to see them under the microscope. Each dot represents a gene, and we can place 20,000 of them in the area of your thumbnail. So on a microscope slide, in the area of your thumbnail, we now have on one slide an ability to read out 20,000 genes. So here is this dream that I talked about saving all of these person hours of time in the lab and being able to take an actual kind of whole look at the patient. And that's what these little dots look like here. We use some techniques to actually see whether or not, and this is blown up, for example, whether or not a gene is expressed higher or lower than normal tissues in a specific patient. So if it's expressed higher, it will be a very high green to yellow ratio. If it's lower than a normal gene, it'll be expressed as a red point. And we can use a laser to scan all of this information and simultaneously now read out not one gene, but 20,000 genes. And we want to do this with each and every single patient that comes through Princess Margaret Hospital for prostate in that intermediate risk group, which I said was a little bit difficult to say exactly how the patients were going to be done, and use that to now predict how patients in the next 5 years are going to actually be doing. And based on having this information, then comparing how the patient actually does with radiation therapy. So now, that's great for one patient with 20,000 genes. What if we found a gene from that screen, and now we wanted to compare 200 patients for only one gene because we actually had the ability to use this microarray to derive this information? Well, this is called a tissue array. So the other one was called the DNA microarray. This is an ability to take individual patients' biopsies that are in a paraffin block in the pathologist's office and punch out cores. So each one of these cores would represent a patient with prostate cancer, slice through the cores to give very thin sections onto a slide, and now we can stain, for example, each one of these is one patient, maybe we can stain all 200 intermediate risk group patients for a specific marker, these are a number of them. If it's brown, it means it's positive for the specific marker, and have a new way of diagnosing or a quick way of diagnosing whether or not a patient is going to do well or not. So this combination of us being able to look at thousands of genes, but then also look at hundreds of patients now, allows us to compare one patient versus another, even within a low-risk category, or all the patients in an intermediate-risk category, or all the patients in a high-risk category, and allows us to make potentially better decisions about their care. And then the last thing I'm going to talk about are so-called proteins. Now, you don't have to understand the slide at all, other than we can collect blood, or we can take a biopsy of a patient, and over the last 5 years, there's a new machine that can break down all of the proteins in those samples and give a certain profile. Okay, and it will be different in normal cells versus cancer cells. We think it probably is different in those patients that will actually respond to radiation or surgery and those who might not, or those patients who might have risk of distant spread. And we have a cancer-associated pattern or a resistance-associated pattern that we can read out. So my lab is just starting to do these sorts of studies with some experimental systems, and we hope to move to patient biopsies in the next 6 months or so. So What's the dream of this? Well, if we had an individual profile or an individual genetic treatment, genetic fingerprint for each patient, right now we give a standard treatment for all patients in which we know that the group of men who are in this room are all different genetically. But we may give a number of you of the same treatment because you're in a certain risk category. So that means that potentially few or maybe some will benefit, but maybe not all because we didn't have the readout on each one of you as an individual. But if we actually genetically fingerprint, then we can come up with a way to specifically treat your cancer versus your cancer versus your cancer. And that means that each of you will individually benefit to the best treatment that we can give. And we don't lump you in with another category of patient in which we would give a treatment that wasn't effective for yours. So that's what we're actually talking about here. Now, in order for us to do this, I'm talking a lot about biopsies here, and as part of the clinical trials of Princess Margaret, we have wonderful patients who sometimes go that extra mile, and it's not really the extra mile, but sometimes feel comfortable with allowing us to take another biopsy for our research. And not every patient we can approach for this, and not every patient may wish to do that. But the point is that there are a lot of biopsies for patients. We understand that, and we thank them greatly for giving us tissue. But wouldn't it be nice to not have to do biopsies? And for me to get the same sorts of information on the genes on the basis now of something that's non-invasive. So let's dream about an X-ray now that can give me like a DNA microarray, in other words, a genetic fingerprint of a patient, without me having to take a biopsy. And could we use that technology to potentially track where a tumor is in the body, first of all? Is it totally confined to the prostate? Or if there was a little 10,000 cell deposit that I can't see by a bone scan or CT scan, would this now allow me to see that? The second issue is, during the radiation therapy, could I understand how the genes are being expressed following the radiation treatments that tells me whether I've got a winning treatment protocol with this patient, or actually I'm not doing really very much at all with the radiation. I know that they're going to fail. And that means that I could either change the radiation treatment or actually send them to surgery. So this is a so-called image-guided molecular radiation therapy. Big words, what does it mean? It means basically trying to look at the molecules during radiation therapy or before radiation therapy and design better treatments. So one type of treatment is called functional imaging. And this particular gene here, and it could be any gene really that's involved in radiation responses, is called P53 or P53. It's one of the more famous cancer genes. About 30% of all tumors actually have mutated P53 genes. And this was a new way of actually detecting whether or not you could see the P53 gene being activated following radiation. And I just want you to look, this is actually in an animal, and there are two areas of the tumor, one that's on the left shoulder, one's on the right shoulder. Here are the little whiskers in the schematic diagram. And here's a non-treated tumor. And here is a tumor that was treated with, for example, with chemotherapy, and they also did it with radiation therapy. And you can actually see the lighting up of this particular area, which means it's, the gene has been activated. And we think that this particular gene, if it's activated or not activated in tumors, can actually give us information about whether the patient will be responsive to radiation or chemotherapy. So this is actually using what's called PET scanning or positron emission tomography scanning, and many of our hospitals will have PET scanners in the next 5 to 10 years. It's in the United States, it turns out that almost all hospitals currently have one. At Princess Margaret Hospital, we actually will have one hooked up to a radiation planning machine, which I'll show you in a moment. So this concept here is that maybe we can actually track the turning on of genes during radiation therapy without taking a biopsy, but using a special scanner. The other issue is what we call, again, functional imaging. What we mean by that is so-called imaging the function of cells during a particular process. And this, again, goes back to this biology-technology link that we have. And that is, if this is a CAT scan, a slice through the body, here is the rectum with a little bit of gas in the rectum. This prostate is where you see this fine line of a circle, and the bladder is just in front of it. We can actually look to see what the blood flow is within this prostate gland using a special type of CAT scan with a blood flow monitor, and this can tell us exactly where the tumor is. You can't see it very well, but the actual tumor is here, but it's picked up quite nicely by this new technology. Now, we'd say, well, does that really help us with radiation? Because we know that we're going to treat the entire prostate gland anyways, but it sure might help us with radiation about 2 years later when we see the PSA is going up slightly, and we were trying to ask, is there a focus or is there an area of tumor that's reactivated inside the prostate, and we could utilize this technology to potentially look for that. There's another spectroscopy type of imaging, and I'm not sure how well this comes out, but basically with an MRI scan, we can actually look at the signatures of the biochemicals within the cells to actually see, give again a readout to see whether or not cancer exists or not. And this is a patient following BRCA therapy who unfortunately it looked like that the PSA was slightly going up, and we wanted to know whether or not there was an active focus of tumor in the bracket therapy treated patient about a year later, and we could see that there was a hot spot based on the biochemistry of this particular region. And indeed, when we put a needle there, we came back with positive cells, and that patient went on to be salvaged with a new type of therapy called photodynamic therapy or light therapy. And I can talk to you, some of you, about that during the coffee break if you want. And this MRI scan, this is actually, what you probably can see is a fish, all right? This is not a person, but we can actually use MRI now with a very fancy technology to give beautiful pictures of organisms, and hopefully soon man, in which the blue here actually represents a gene that's being turned on during development of this fish, but we hope to be able to utilize it for radiation treatments. So here's an MRI scan now with a new use, a new technology, and again, we could track patients during the radiation therapy or after the radiation, and not only track them with PSA, but also imaging about how patients are responding. So in the last 5 minutes before the coffee break, and then I'll talk for about another 10 minutes after the coffee break, I want to just finish off with again, some imaging techniques. I said one of the issues associated with the microenvironment was the level of oxygenation. And it turns out that in normal vasculature, the red blood cells go very well through the blood vessels, and that means that oxygen gets to the tissues quite nicely, and it means that in a given normal organ, such as a normal prostate or a normal liver, there's well equal perfusion through the entire organ. Tumor isn't like that. Tumors actually developed very, very tortuous and strange architecture of their blood vessels so that you can get what's called low oxygen levels, the so-called term hypoxia, because of either opening and shutting down of blood vessels because there's spasticity, it's just like kind of snapping shut and then snapping open again. Or, for example, sometimes tumor cells grow away from the blood vasculature and have low oxygen levels. And so people are interested in, well, is a hypoxic cell or a low oxygen cell different than a high oxygen cell? And here is just an example of normal blood vessels in the lung, and here it is in a tumor where there's tortuosity and the architecture is completely done, different. Well, yeah, actually hypoxic cells are important, particularly for radiotherapy and chemotherapy, because it turns out that if this is a blood vessel and as you go increasing distance away from the blood vessel, you're having lower levels of oxygen just because it can't diffuse to those cells. So you can get these hypoxic cells out here. And you know, when we've looked at the relative sensitivity to radiation, chemotherapy, and whether or not they have normal growth, it turns out they're very abnormal and very resistant. So we'd like to predict those cells and then do something about them. So some of you in this room may have been involved, again, as part of a research study, to detect oxygenation within the tumor prior to radiation therapy. And so many of you know the transrectal ultrasound, and here is a small needle that is actually within the ultrasound probe that actually goes straight into the nodule of the prostate when the man is actually in the imaging position, and we actually measure the very tip of this probe with this oxygen machine here, the oxygen level within inside the tumor. And we're collecting all of these oxygen measurements on the patients that are receiving this high-dose radiation, in addition to sometimes taking some biopsies for some of the genetic studies that I talked about, this so-called DNA microarray, to try to predict how patients will do. And right now, I can tell you, we know that hypoxia definitely exists in prostate cancer. There's some suggestion that patients who have hypoxic values may do a little bit less well with radiation, and we have novel ways to actually combat that in terms of new drugs. So from Princess Margaret Hospital, in terms of the clinical laboratory, basically it would be great if we could take some of these tests, and hopefully they'll be non-invasive, like I showed you with these special x-rays, and be able to determine a signature for each individual patient as a guide to therapy, and also potentially, as I said, we can use these tests also. If they work for radiation, they'll also potentially work for surgery as well as looking at risk. And I'm going to end on this slide so we can take a coffee break just before 8 and say that this is, again, going back to the impact of us having this knowledge. And we say, again, this term of biomarkers for the individual. Let's say, again, that 70% of men, based on this high-dose radiation technique, are going to do well, and the other 30% may actually not do well with radiation. Well, if I could predict before the radiation therapy, if I had biomarkers or a microarray or hypoxic measurement that said, aha, this patient is going to be successful with the radiation therapy, then we go on with therapy. They go on to receive high-dose conformal radiotherapy or brachytherapy because we know that they're going to be sensitive to that type of therapy. If, however, I had some information that, in fact, before we even started the radiation, that there were failure factors, those factors that actually would predict that the tumor was resistant, maybe in the 30% of other patients, well, now I have some options, and so does the patient, even more options. First of all, I get to tell them, actually, radiation is not good for you, and that means that you should go back to and have surgery if that's a good option for them. And that means I haven't wasted that man's time on 8.5 weeks of radiation therapy for a technique that actually is not going to work best for them. It makes my results look better in terms of a radiation oncologist. It makes the surgeon's results work better. But most importantly, it's better for the patient because we now have individualized the treatment. What if that patient, however, was maybe 75, had a number of problems with their heart or lungs, and it made difficulty with the operation? Well, then these genetic factors I could utilize to target, for example, the low oxygen levels, because I have actual ways to do that now in terms of new drugs over the last 3 years. That P53 gene that we talked about, there's actually some gene therapy that are being tested out in, for example, the United States, that are being utilized with radiation. It looks like it will sensitize some of the resistant tumors now back to sensitive tumors. And this is the basis for trying to develop the so-called molecular profiling for individual patients at our institute and hopefully across Canada. That's why we have these networks that were mentioned that I'm a part of, is to try to really get the word out that if we can collect the information on hundreds of men, then we can use that to really predict how the next cohort or the next group of men are going to do, and we can test out whether or not, in fact, that these are important factors for men. And I think that they will be. Already we have evidence from prostate cancer, breast cancer, lymphoma, that these microarrays or genetic tests give us much more information than we've ever had before. So what I want to do when we come back is really just keep you another 5 to 10 minutes and talk to you about how do we integrate all of this in terms of this new fancy machine, this CT-guided radiation therapy machine, and how do we put it all together to get the best treatments for patients. And maybe now is a good time for some coffee. Okay. Put a limit on this, right? 10 minutes and not a minute more to finish off tonight, because I know I've just been whacking you out with all these slides with fancy things, etc., and it just becomes overwhelming. Try working in the field. But what I wanted to do now is talk about a couple of special machines and try to put, again, everything together from where we started. So let's move ahead and talk about this so-called precision radiotherapy. I've already talked about a couple of concepts relating to precision radiotherapy, and that is the so-called conformal radiation therapy, the use of seeds inside a prostate so we can track the prostate when it moves, and therefore we can be on target each day and we can see which way the seeds are moving, which means that it's whether the bladder is more or less full or the rectum is more or less full. But you know what? Still, the prostate can move even during the treatment. So let's say it takes 5 minutes to deliver the radiation dose, each one of the 42 treatments. The prostate can move slightly during that treatment. So we want to get so precise that even if the prostate moves slightly, we'd be able to track that and in real time over the 5 minutes make adjustments. Okay. The other issue is the reason that we're interested in that not only is to give high dose to the tumor, but it's to protect normal tissues as well, the so-called ratio of benefits against the disadvantages of a treatment. And now we have to understand both the anatomy as well as the biology, and some of the genes that I've talked about will help us with that. Well, I'm not sure how well this projects, actually, but for some of you that have had radiation treatments, you can notice that this is a bed in the middle of the room, and there's a large machine above that gives the radiation treatments through this aperture, and this whole machine gantries around in a 360 degrees. And some patients may receive 6 beams, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So 2 from the front on angles, 2 from the back, and 2 from the side that all intersect in the middle of the body to give this high dose that I showed you in kind of the red in that colorful diagram of how the beams were coming in. With IMRT radiation therapy, we actually can change the number of beams depending on the patient's anatomy. So some patients may only get 5 beams, others may get 9. It all depends on their anatomy. And then there's a slight difference with this radiation treatment machine here. So if anyone's had radiation brave enough to say, is there anything different about this machine? A sensor, right. So there's something here, right? Right, and you probably didn't see that before. Well, this actually is a miniature CT scan. So instead of having a CT scan separate to the radiation treatment machine, we have a new machine, which is only one of 3 in the world, that we have developed that actually has a CT scan as part of the radiation treatment machine. And as this gantry goes around, it can take beautiful pictures inside the anatomy. The prostate gland is actually right here. And the CT scan can give information in real time back and forth, almost like a global satellite system, to monitor the movement of the organ inside the body as the gantry is turning around. So this is called cone beam CT. As I said, it was on Global News October 27th. And we are now going into a large deal of research with this machine to basically get it up and running and to be able to use it in patients. And it looks quite promising to be able to give much better radiation in terms of precision than even we have today. And today is not bad. The other issue is so-called CAT scan PET imaging. PET stands for positron emission tomography. What does that mean? It means that we can inject chemicals into the body, so it's one injection, and then we can actually monitor the biology of that chemical, and that might have to do with low oxygen levels, or as I showed you with that mouse, the turning on of a specific gene, and overlay it on top of the CAT scan that we use for planning the radiation therapy. In this particular case, this is a breast patient, but we can actually then layer on top the biology of the disease on top of a CAT scan and then utilize that. So the true goal of this is to use a cone beam CT, where the CT is now part of the gantry, and be actually using PET imaging as well to get the biology. And instead of giving, for example, 42 treatments to the entire prostate, we'll still do that, but then we'll give an extra boost just maybe to 2 or 3 centimeter nodule within the prostate, maybe to another 2 or 3 weeks, in order to develop high dose and precision where we need it to those areas of the prostate that have resistant genes, or the areas of the prostate that have low oxygen levels that could cause resistance. So that's where we hope to be in the next 5 to 10 years. Now, we can't throw the baby out with the bathwater, okay? And here is a little boy reading Harry Potter and kind of a cobweb on the computer, which is the concept that quite a bit has been learned by clinical acumen or clinical experience. So this technology in no way is going to usurp. You're not going to go up and order your radiotherapy like you do fries at McDonald's. But we have to use the technology quite wisely in order for us to really be able to use it in the best circumstances and look at the whole patient. And multiple factors, including the PSA and the Gleason score, plus the genetic test, will help us to guide cancer treatment. And I'm just going to skip over this particular slide. So our clinical research program at Princess Margaret Hospital, and indeed at a number of research hospitals, is about taking things in the lab. So I have a lab upstairs on the 10th floor, and that's why I'm wearing jeans today, because I was in the lab with my graduate students and postdoctoral fellows. And here we're looking at model systems, animal systems, cells and culture, biochemistry, and trying to understand what those genes might be that we should take to the clinic. We've got these biopsies and oxygen measurements that I've talked to you about that we can crosstalk, and if we find something new, we can drive it back to the lab and try to understand it. If we have something in the lab, we can drive it into the clinic and try to understand it. And of course, the basis of this are innovative treatments. And so right now, for example, my lab and other labs are using certain molecular targeted drugs that work with the radiation to sensitize cells that would otherwise be resistant based on their genetic factors. So that day is here now. Again, it's just in the laboratory or preclinical state in experimental model systems, but we hope in another year or two to drive it through to the clinic. So these things are attainable. We can't be cocky, though, and it's always a sobering thought to make sure that, just as, again, we have to be careful in the ethics about how we do these, how we take all of this genetic information and make sure that the wrong information doesn't get to the wrong people, we also have to study the treatment methods very carefully and make sure that they're safe and they're effective for each one of the patients that come through the system. Because the pitfalls are that we actually just, instead of using our brains and talking to our patients, we just use technology, and we basically give all of our life's work to computers and allow them to think with us. And sometimes there have been problems with that in terms of how we give radiation treatment. And we also don't want to be silly and not understand that in some patients there could be cells just beyond the prostate. And if we give this very, very tight margin with these newfangled precision radiotherapy, maybe we're so tight that, in fact, we miss some of the cells outside that don't get radiation therapy. So, in fact, the treatment becomes not effective. So we have to be very savvy in how we use it. And the other issue is that we need a very, what we call, systematic or very logical approach to using molecular-guided radiation therapy and choose the right molecules to track in the right patients in order to get the best results. So in this 21st century, what we call translational, which I agree is a big word, and the idea is to translate from the lab to the clinic and the clinic back to the lab, we're trying to fill in the gaps. I mean, there was this huge eruption of biology knowledge and genes, and you just could read all the time in newspapers 10 years ago about all of these things. And then there was all this hope and promise that the next day you're going to get all these newfangled treatments, and it hasn't always occurred that way. In fact, you know, if we really are critical, we have to say that how many new treatments are there today that are standard based on the biology that was exploding 15 years ago? And the answer is there are a few, but not as many as maybe we all expected. And that's because you know, this cartoon says there's all this complication and then a miracle occurs. In other words, there's still a black box in terms of putting all the information together. And I think that's where we're at. We know about the genes. We're trying to put it together and then ask what are the most important genes or which are the most important genes for each patient. So let's end off in the last two slides with that same case that I talked about, which at the very beginning of this was about a 1 centimeter lump of the prostate going on to receive IMRT. In 10 years from now, we may not even be giving radiation therapy any longer. Maybe I'm out of a job, but the idea is that maybe we know enough molecular biology that we can use a molecular drug to actually slow something down or take those abnormal blood vessels and create normal blood vessels so the tumor actually stops growing. And maybe that would last, if you were 70 years of age, until your last days, never requiring any treatment, even if you were a Gleason score of 8 and a PSA of 20. Okay? But we still have something up our sleeve, which is surgery or radiation in case that didn't work. So here's maybe a letter in 10 years. Again, 1 centimeter lump in the left prostate, PET scanning, shows no evidence of spread, and therefore he has curative disease. Did a genetic profile, came up with a couple of genes, P53 and this other gene RAS, and therefore I started him a molecular agent called Erastin, okay, against the RAS gene, and that's probably all that this patient needs. We'll follow the PSA and the gene expression profile, again with PET, and then basically overall survival at 10 years is 98%. Okay, that's a dream, but then we said we would be dreaming tonight, so why not, right? And if the PSA rises and the genetic profiling alters, he's still a candidate for now salvage IMRT, plus or minus a fancy drug, with little chance of side effects, as he has no contraindications, because I also looked at all the genes that he could have that would repair DNA and they were all fine. In other words, he could repair the normal cells. Although anxious, I'm reassured, and they're off to Florida to spend their RSPs. Okay, best regards, Rob Bristow. And that could be something in the future. Now, we have to be careful about hype versus hope. But I think we're in a very active program now of hope, whereas I think maybe 10 years ago there was a lot of hype. And the reason I say that is that, in fact, the hope issue is that most of the technology is being worked out. We're able to get tissue from patients and actually get some of the answers. And now we're actively tracking these genetic profiles in patients. And it'll take about 5 or 10 years for us to really know whether or not we can predict. But already the early indicators are quite strong. So I'm going to end this talk by really acknowledging the most important people in this, who are our patients at Princess Margaret, who time and time again let us know how the treatment is working or not in terms of side effects, how we can help them, but also are part of clinical trials. And if you're asked to take part into a clinical trial, be critical, ask all the questions, and then if you feel that it's right, go into it, because it will help maybe yourself, but also other people as we all struggle together against this disease. The radiation medicine program, my colleagues, other radiation oncologists, those wonderful therapists who are on the machines, and of course the clinical research program, which are all the surgeons and the medical oncologists, the radiologists, pathologists, for certain the nurses, and also the foundation. And I have a number of very very kind grants from peer-reviewed agencies who allow us to do this work. So I thank you for your attention tonight. Keep being critical. Read about these articles in the Globe and Mail. Ask your doctors about things as they're coming up. Remain inquisitive. And I hope we're all doing better if I give this talk in 5 or 10 years from now, and maybe I can write that letter the way I said. Okay, so thank you.
Are there any questions first for the doctor?
Doctor, how are you? How is your department funded?
There are two aspects of the funding. The first is what we call peer-reviewed grants. And so these are grants that would be given by the National Cancer Institute of Canada or the Canadian Institutes of Health Research. These are large granting bodies which I would, for example, apply for money, tell them my ideas, describe the experiments in detail, and they would rank me relative to another scientist, and then the relative ranking comes out, and there's a certain amount of money, and those scientists get the grants, and those granting cycles are about 2 or 3 times per year. So that's one, and that's what some of these partners that I've listed down here, including, believe it or not, the U.S. Army, Department of Defense, actually has a prostate research program in which some of the Cold War monies have been actually apportioned to this. So that's one way. The other way is through the Princess Margaret Hospital Foundation. So it's kind gifts, for example, people in this audience or other audience who say, you know, I've been thinking about giving a donation and this sounds quite interesting and I'd like to be a part of this. So it's through that partnering as well with the donors that we actually develop these programs. In truth and reality, although I think I'm very fortunate right now to have some very strong funding from the peer-reviewed agencies as well as the foundation, everything in life goes through cycles. And a year and a half ago, it was very difficult to get some funding because everyone has a different idea of what is the most important research to fund at a certain amount of time. So I think the foundation actually helps us to a great extent by, number one, it allows patients to potentially either help us raise money through different ways of walks, or we had a dragon boat race, for example, for prostate cancer research just at Heart Lake here not too long ago for another foundation that I'm part of, or also giving potential donations because it allows us to ramp up, so it gives us momentum. These sorts of grants that come from the government allow us to do our day-to-day and really kind of forge ahead, and we try to be as quick as we can. The extra monies from the foundation allow us to basically do it twice or three or four times as fast because patients want answers and they want new treatments. And I think everyone, yes, they're willing to listen to a scientist talk about these newfangled, you know, tests, et cetera, but really, fundamentally, everyone, including myself, we want to see this translate into better diagnostics or better treatments for patients. And so hopefully that explains a little bit about how our funding is given. Other questions? Anything at all?
Does the higher intake of protein help in the in preventing the spread of cancer?
I don't think there's any particular evidence that specific proteins actually increase or decrease the rate of cancer. As we were talking about, there is a potential role of increased fats in the diet that can give rise to an increased risk for prostate cancer. And also, many of you are aware of, and I'm sure you'll have talks about this, or it's on the website, about so-called antioxidants. So these are called lycopenes, which are basically from processed tomatoes. Some people will be using vitamin E, for example, or vitamin C, again, to try to reduce the risk of cancer. I was having a talk with some of you, which is that actually during radiation therapy, we ask patients to come off those antioxidants because the way that radiation works, it has to cause the free radicals, the oxidative damage, to kill the cancer cells. So if you have the antioxidants, sometimes it can work against the radiation. So we ask the patients to come off those antioxidants during the radiation and go back on a week later. But at the present time, having increased number of proteins in terms of a definite increase in either the aggressiveness of prostate cancer or the risk, it's highly controversial. I think the data is very weak. For fat intake, the data is much better, and so we should all be having a fairly healthy diets in order to make sure that either we prevent ourselves from having prostate cancer. The difficulty thing, to be honest with you, gang, is that once you have a diagnosis of prostate cancer, all of these concepts we've talked about in terms of antioxidants and diet, etc., it's a little bit more controversial, for example, whether it will slow the disease down once you have it. So for most of these things, it's about getting it. In other words, trying to prevent the actual cancer. And there's active research now to try to see whether or not the use of antioxidants or change in diet will actually help with what the response is to radiation therapy or to surgery. And I think the jury is still out on that. In my practice, what I tell patients when they say that I'm using antioxidants, doctor, after the radiation, is that okay? I say, absolutely. I don't have any data to suggest it's doing you any harm. And I think complementary medicine exists with this type of medicine as long as we know that they're not clashing against each other. So. Other questions?
Doctor, I'd like to thank you for your talk this evening. It's been very enlightening. And I like your dream. I really do. 10 years from now, I hope it's as you say it is. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.